And welcome to the Raucous Caucus. I am Mark Levine, here with
Terry D. Kester
and
Garland Nixon.
And they're both trying to speak at the same time, which is typical for the Raucous Caucus. If you
it's
haven't checked us out,
the first time we've done that.
The 103rd time, maybe. This is the Raucous Caucus. We are live at noon on Sundays, every Sunday on WEACT Radio, 1480 AM. And we're very glad to have you with us. Every Sunday, we each deal with our own topic, and then we comment a lot on each other's, because usually I'm right and the other two are wrong, so I've got to, you know, tell them how I think.
Or, you know, the topics don't make any sense, and I have to explain them.
I see. And or Garland has to separate the two of us.
Well, yes. I always kind of thought of it as we were all kind of struggling with our own demons, more so than our individual pockets.
Well, I stopped drinking. Thank you.
Actually, Pat Robertson says that there's demons in all your old belongings. But that's not our topic tonight. Our topic is today, I should say. Garland wants to talk about student researchers discovering DNA in a cosmic cloud, which is literally way over my head. And then Terry wants to talk about perpetual war, which it seems to me that, well, Terry as an ex-hippie is always in perpetual war. And
well, then I mean, that's the American dream.
And then I want to talk about Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which came before the United States Supreme Court, because apparently racism is over in America, so says Justice Scalia. So those are our three topics today. We're going to start with you this week, Garland. Something about cosmic DNA. What are we talking about?
Well, first of all, could there be any the three topics that were any more different than those three?
That's true. We are different people.
DNA, we've got Section 5, and perpetual war. This is going to be a great weekend.
This will be raucous.
And all of this is going to raise the cost of healthcare.
There is it just struck me for some reason. There's an article on rawstory.com, student researchers discover building blocks of DNA in cosmic cloud. So basically what happened is students at the University of West Virginia looked through this humongous telescope, and basically they found the chemicals, the two prebiotic molecules that are key to the formation of DNA and the amino acid alanine. What does that mean? Basically what they're saying is the idea that life is just some kind of a once in a trillion year coincidence that things happen to fall together on Earth, and that we were here, and that it could happen nowhere else in the universe, is starting to fall apart. And it appears that in the center of the very center of the Milky Way galaxy, there are the very makings of life. And that what they basically said is, what it appears is that when these stars are forming and planets are forming and things of that nature, the very seeds of life are on the planets when they form, so that if the conditions become right on a given planet, there's a good likelihood that life is all ready to form just like a planted field. I'm interested to hear what Terry has to say about that.
I'm just curious to know if the mutations lead to Terry D. Kester, but I'm not sure. Go ahead, Terry.
Well, first off, you know, we should all brush our teeth with alanine. But I find this fascinating, and I've read a bit about it, and there's two ways to look at it. One, it's miraculous and fascinating, and yes, the possibility exists, of course, and it's always existed. I mean, to sit around, other than the Raucous Caucus, there's not much uniqueness in the universe, you know. But the other side of that coin is the variables, the complexity of events that have to come together for any life form to develop are so layered and so complex that, yeah, you could probably have parts of life-forming things and elements and minerals and, you know, hormones and everything else spread all over the universe that are all possible of creating life, but for them to gather and actually be in the right spot at the right time with the right weather, with the right pressure, with the right amount of water, with the right et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, is still not proven to be found anywhere else or even close to it. So it remains a mystery, but it gets more and more fascinating every day.
Well, I guess that we shouldn't be surprised we're not alone in the universe. I mean, I'd go back to, I think it was Copernicus, right, who challenged the idea that the Earth was the center of the universe and was excommunicated. Or was it Galileo?
Galileo.
It's Galileo.
He challenged Copernicus.
Oh, okay. Yep. Copernicus said the Earth was in the center, and Galileo, all I recall is they're both excommunicated, and the Catholic Church a couple years back said, oh, maybe they were right. To me, that just makes me think of how late the Catholic Church is. I don't know what to think about this, because it's so many light years away. I mean, what's the thought, Garland? Because I never thought we were alone in the universe. Is that the heart of it, or is it that this could have some influence in the way we actually think about things?
Well, it with me, it certainly does, because I think, you know, that it takes me away a little from what Terry was saying, and that is that the environment has to, the habitat has to be perfect for life to form as we understand it, that all of the chemicals and oxygens, et cetera. Now, if in fact you have the building blocks for life floating around there pretty much everywhere, like a giant, like the universe is a giant field, certainly, you know, DNA and life changes and diversifies itself. Even in the even on Earth, there are many, many areas. They've found these superheated volcanoes where there are bacteria that can live in hundreds of degrees heat. And then they found unbelievable cold where there's life that can live there. So the idea that you have to have perfect a perfect environment for life, even the Earth has proven that that is not that idea is not real. So and we have both aerobic and anaerobic bacteria, which live with or without oxygen. So my point being this, I think that number one, this shows that life on the on this country, on this Earth, isn't as rare in the universe as we would think, and that life is waiting to form, and given a particular habitat, it can adjust itself to form and create and then adapt to that given environment on a given planet that may be different than ours.
Terry,
that's not correct. Partially correct. Don't misunderstand me here. But, you know, the key thing is life adapting. At the moment, what we understand as life and anywhere, whether it's in a volcano on the bottom of the ocean or not, is for the most part, and I'm pretty sure this is true at this point, carbon-based. So, yes, life can form, but it can adapt in billions of ways, and, you know, it will adapt.
There's plenty of carbon in the universe, so I don't think we have a shortage.
No, but there is the possibility, and I don't know if it's actually been discovered, but there is a possibility of a silicon-based life form as well, which is silicon's right next to carbon in the atomic table. So there is that distinct possibility.
See, I keep wanting to go to theology with all these things because, to me, there's still schools in the South where they don't want to teach evolution or they want to teach creationism alongside evolution. And I see this is actually both. This is clear evidence of evolution and clear evidence of the incredible widespread nature and power of nature. But to me, theologically, actually, if you do believe in a divine being, I mean, this is incredible. This is incredibly wonderful that these seeds of life are everywhere. And if you think a little more broadly about a cosmic force in the universe, And your notion of God is sort of a large one. This is amazing and certainly worthy of veneration, put it that way.
And certainly, you know, there's been the argument made that the Earth is, in fact, a living creature, and that we are, if you think about your body, you've got millions of bacteria and various organisms all over your body. You're not a one, you're a we. And all of these things exist, and you can't exist without all of them. So you've got billions and billions of different types and different bacteria and different creatures living all on and around you that allow you to exist.
So, Garland, you're calling us all parasites.
The argument could be made that the Earth is the same thing as a person, and we are no more than bacteria, particularly Terry, I might add, but some of us are less bacteria than others.
I think you're calling us all parasites.
On the Earth's colon.
I just want you to know that I'm down. I only have 6 bacteria. I've gotten rid of all the other ones, so I'm kind of unique and wonderful.
Oh, yeah, but Garland called you a parasite. I heard it here.
Know, but you know, this is well. Let's not get into Garland's details.
Not parasite. We need Terry to survive. He's like friendly flora in our colon.
Oh, he's like beneficial bacteria.
That's it.
Somehow crawling in our feces. I don't know if that's a very nice image to use for Terry, but
no, this is not pleasant, guys. This is not pleasant. You know, I mean, I'm sitting here in pain, deep emotional, spiritual, and theological pain.
And intestinal pain, apparently.
And intestinal pain. But, you know, there is the key point is we haven't gotten away from thinking that we are the center of the universe. We do that. You know, that's what individualism is about. That's what exceptionalism is about. It's just another way of saying I, and even occasionally we when we refer to the nation, we are the center of everything. It's pure narcissism. Obviously, we're not. If anybody pays attention to the universe, to our neighbors, to anything else, even if they pay attention to Garland, they'll find out that we are not the center of the universe.
What's interesting is that it's all levels. There are people who think that they are the center of the universe. There are people who think their families are, or their city. Yep. New Yorkers, right? New York thinks they're the center of the universe. Mm-hmm. And then you've got, obviously, Americans thinking that we, America, we're the most important nation in the universe. And then, of course, humans in general, which is, I guess, what this article is about, certainly humanity thinks it's the center of the universe. And so, to me, I don't know. You can look at this and say, well, we're small. We're relatively unimportant. You know, we're the third planet going around a fairly undignified and unimportant star in a back wing of the Milky Way. That's true. On the other hand, to me, this just shows the wondrous power that's out there, and I see it as a positive, exciting thing. But
well, it should be humbling to realize once again we're hanging around in the slums of the universe.
Yeah, well, the sun never got a fair deal. You know, the sun tried to get into all the good clubs in the center of the Milky Way, and apparently wasn't wearing the right clothes.
And the universe has given us free housing. We have our own planet. So the universe is I guess the universe is kind of a communist, you know? It's stuck us all together. It's given us free housing and free food.
And free energy. I mean, the sun just keeps going and going and going every day, 24/7, never paid, just keeps burning out, and apparently everybody uses it. I mean, whether plants, every piece of energy on Earth comes from the sun, every single bit of it, photosynthesis and everything else.
And also, you know, if you look at all the science, and I just recently got a Scientific American because I love to delve into that stuff. You know, scientists and astronomers and cosmetologists are constantly looking at what is the various connecting forces in the universe. And once again, the deeper we go, the more we discover, the more the universe itself is interconnected in a billion different ways. And we don't even begin to understand it. In other words, space is not empty. And this is pretty much a given fact at this point. We don't know what the heck it is. We have all kinds of theories about it, from strings to everything else to just being information, as a matter of fact, is a new theory. But in any case, it's not empty. So we're all interconnected on a universal level, too.
Right. And you know, I think one of the things that we do is we very narrowly define the life, you know, into the carbon-based understanding. Because when we talk about stars, a star is born, a star has a lifespan, and a star eventually dies. Everything in our universe repeats the same cycle. You could make an argument that a star is a form of life. I mean, so the idea, I think, that we have of life is we say this particular thing is life because we're it. So it's got to be life, and nothing else is life. Just like we say, well, we are the greatest creatures on Earth. Why? Because we have large prefrontal cortexes, and we can think differently than the other animals. Well, if you ask a tree would say, I live 1,000 years. You guys live 70 years. If you ask an elephant, he'd say, well, look at the size of me. You little guys can't even protect yourself. So any given life form, if you ask a cockroach, he's going to say, you guys can't make it through a nuclear disaster. So any given life form.
Apparently, Garland is talking to cockroaches again.
I'm the greatest life form on Earth. The only one that counts. In the universe.
Garland's talking to cockroaches.
He's talking to cockroaches and trees. I think he needs some help.
I think he does.
I'll tell you something. Let me say one more thing. Lindsay Lohan may be a star, but I don't think she's a life form. I just got to put that out there.
Oh, there you go.
Very good.
Well, that's what I heard from talking to the cockroach. I mean, I don't really know.
Oh, you've been talking to him too, huh?
No, I just through Garland. He translates for me.
Yeah.
That's it. Mark, I am the cockroach and the tree and the elephant. We are all one. Is that right, Terry? Is there any difference between me and them?
Your images today, Garland, just aren't quite working. We've got some serious problems here. But we thank you for the effort.
We do. I think actually it's time to move on to our next topic. So we've gone from perpetual life to perpetual death and perpetual war. And Terry's going to enlighten us on that when we come right back right after this. To the Raucous Caucus. This is Mark Levine. I've got on the line
Terry D. Kester
and
Garland Nixon.
who has just finished talking to cockroaches and apparently has come back to talk with us. We're very glad.
And solving the secrets and mysteries of the universe, we might add.
Yes, which he learned from apparently some tree. So what do we know? Yeah. Anyways, Garland's been talking about perpetual life discovered in the center of the Milky Way. Terry, you want to talk about perpetual death, I guess.
No, I would hope not, but it leads to the same thing. And I'm talking about perpetual war. And if you remember, President Obama made the statement, which was somewhat shocking to people to pay attention. We the people still believe that enduring security and lasting peace do not require perpetual war, despite the fact that we are in perpetual war. The latter part is my ad, and he didn't say that, but it's true. We are in perpetual war. And beginning to think about this and the destructiveness of one, you know, the whole wonderful book of Orwell's 1984, I mean, the whole foundation of those societies is perpetual war. And in looking at just war, this is something that I've been aware of for a long time, but whether you talk about the military-industrial complex or you talk about perpetual war, you're talking about the same thing. Discovered, of course, once again, Alexis de Tocqueville made the most astounding commentary on this back in 1840. And let me just read you a little bit of this. It was from a volume of his, Why Democratic Nations Naturally Desire Peace and Democratic Armies Desire War. Quote, "No protected war can fail to endanger the freedom of a democratic country. War does not always give over democratic communities to military government, but it must invariably and immeasurably increase the power of civil government. It must almost compulsorily concentrate the direction of all men and the management of all things in the hands of the administration. If it does not lead to despotism by sudden violence, it prepares men for it more gently by their habits. All those," this is the key end of his section, "all those who seek to destroy the liberties of a democratic nation ought to know that war is the surest and shortest means to accomplish it. This is the first axiom of the science."
See, all I know, Terry, is that war is peace and freedom is slavery and ignorance is strength. I read 1984. I learned all the lessons that need to be learned from it. And that's what Big Brother taught me.
Yeah, well, that is a profound book. But we are definitely caught into a situation of perpetual war. And if you look at it realistically, we have been at perpetual war ever since World War II, one way or the other. We have not paused for a single moment.
Weren't there a couple years in the 90s when we were not at war under Bill Clinton?
Well, that depends on how you define it. Were we preparing for war? Yes. Were we rearming? Yes. Were we still building missiles and bombs and everything else? Yes. Were we developing drones?
Were we maintaining a no-fly zone over Iraq and, you know, bombing their radar installations every now and then?
Yeah. Were we supporting other countries involved in war?
I don't know. 93, 94. I think there were a couple years there we weren't at war, but I want to get Garland's reaction.
A couple of days.
So Garland, what's your view on all this?
You know, what's unique about the United States, I think, is this. I think in the past there was a period where people used perpetual war to maintain control, to try to broaden their asset base, diversify their asset base, you know, go to other countries, take their stuff, take their goods, keep their people under control. But I think the United States has transitioned into something that's very interesting, and that is, we have an industry in the U.S., which is one of the largest industries, probably maybe the largest industry now, but close to it, that keeps us, you know, that runs our economy. Our economy's engine is now run by war, as we're seeing with the sequester here and all of the defense industry and defense contractors. Right now, without war or without the specter of war, our economy collapses. So we're living on an economic war platform.
You know, Dwight Eisenhower famously warned us about the military-industrial complex, which I should note, God, is the second largest in the United States of anything driving our economy. The largest, by the way, is healthcare, which is one-sixth of our nation's economy, and I would argue, frankly, kills more and causes more damage than war. But that's not our topic tonight.
Well, you know, it doesn't. I mean, healthcare doesn't. That's not a accurate statement.
Well, but, and, you know, my point is that healthcare is just as much of a mess or bigger mess. But we'll focus on the military-industrial complex. So clearly it exists. Clearly it's out there. Clearly it's a big function of our economy. No doubt World War II helped pull us out of a depression, and no doubt the sequester is hurting us now. But then the question is, why can't we use all these funds to build schools or clean sewers or electrification or whatever, job training, Head Start, rather than going to bombs to kill people?
Well, and, you know, the biggest factor in that, and Tocqueville points it out, is what's happened, you know, not with them necessarily taking over or with despotism, but it prepares men, women, society for being taken over more gently by their habits. We have created this incredible culture of war. We believe in war, the drone being a perfect example of this. 77% of Americans think drones are a wonderful thing and should be used. I mean, that's astounding. And again, realizing that with that 77% of approval of drones, there's no outside supervision or oversight.
See, I was just going to say, I am not against drone use per se. In other words, I don't think that bombing someone with an unmanned plane is any more or less moral than bombing someone with a manned plane. My problem is indeed oversight.
And yes,
if,
exactly.
And if we had findings that were, you know, put in some secret court or, you know, there. Like, for example, the memo from the president were more specific than it is rather than vague. And if we had standards for use, you know, someone who had they could show what was an, you know, imminent likelihood of killing Americans or something like that. The problem is the standards are lax and the oversight is lax. I don't think it's the drone per se that's the problem. It's who's watching the drones.
It's just a symbol. And, you know, the latest thing that you've probably heard, which is really kind of amazing, is the now the Distinguished Warfare Medals. You've heard of those?
Well, there's a lot of them. There's Purple Hearts, there's Bronze Star, Silver Star.
That's the specific name of it's the Distinguished Warfare Medal, and it's for drone pilots.
Well, you know, I knew that all those video games would serve me well someday.
Yeah.
So now I can take a joystick and...
Because obviously, and it's actually at this moment, they may change it because there's petitions, like huge number of petitions already signed, but it was going to rank, and does rank for the moment, above the Bronze Star with Valor Medal, which is given for, you know, heroic action actually in combat. Now, we've ranked above that the guy who runs the joystick who drops the bomb.
I mean, I would say there's definitely more valor in risking your life to serve the military than, I mean, I'm glad we have people who are good with the joystick, and that's a certainly an important skill, but no, it's obviously it's not the same as being in battle. Let me get Garland in here. In terms of perpetual war, do you think it's the same as it's been since World War II? Is it better? Is it worse? Where are we going here?
Well, of course, as the power of the military-industrial complex rises, I don't think the issue is better or worse because it's been there. I think the issue is, what are the chances that we'll be able to get out of this mad feedback loop? And they appear to be, you know, we've got two chances, slim and fat. So that's where we are. That's the nation that we are now. We are a warring nation. The other thing, I read an article a while back that was interesting that discussed this same topic from a different perspective. And what they said was, now when our best and brightest minds that come out of MIT or Stanford, wherever they come out of, they go to the military-industrial complex. If we were to take our smartest young scientists and chemists and instead of use their minds to create new ways to exterminate human beings, if we were to inject that intellectual capital into other areas such as green energy and other things, we would be so far ahead of where we are now. The fact of the matter is this. We are way ahead of everybody militarily in our ability to kill people because that's where we put our intellectual capital. That's where we put our personnel. That's where we put all of our money. If we were to put it in other areas, our economy and our standard of life would be so much better. So we choose war and death to our own detriment.
And even Eisenhower pointed that out. And what's significant here, though, is President Obama, as far as I know, and certainly in recent history, is the first one to bring up this idea, this issue. We the people still believe that enduring security and lasting peace do not require perpetual war. Now, I guarantee you the military of the United States disagrees with that 100%. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people disagree with that 100%, but it is heroic of Obama to even bring this idea forward. And if people can grab onto this idea and, again, support him, it's possible that we might make some change. But
unless see, here's
we do
the problem.
Right now, just as an example, we spend 43% of all military expenditure in the entire world. And
wow.
Everybody else has got, you know, everybody from China to Russia, everybody else has got a piece, but we've got 43% of all military spending in the world, and that doesn't count the arms that we are selling to people.
And given that we have the largest economy on the planet, this is something that's really obviously costing a lot and of uses of our economy. I've often wondered why we still have troops in Germany. I mean, World War II is over.
40,000 troops.
And they're expensive, and Germany's not paying us for them. And I don't think Germany is under any particular threat. And the threat to Japan, there may be a threat from North Korea in terms of missiles, but I don't think there's a threat of invasion. Japan and Germany happen to be the second and third largest economies in the world. And if they want our troops there, I'd like to see them at least pay us for them. So,
I guarantee there are a lot of defense contractors who are making a whole pretty penny from these bases, from these huge bases, shipping food, shipping supplies over there, the shippers, you know, and on and on. Because let's not forget what has happened in our military. A lot of the things that the military used to do, now Halliburton and Kellogg, Brown and Root and these other companies and Mantech, et cetera, are doing it. So these bases, what we've got is a military that has a parasite attached to it. And that's military contractors. So they would be fighting closing these bases because there's hundreds of millions of dollars going in their pocket because these bases are open.
Well, it's always been profitable. And particularly profitable for the victor, but it's also profitable for those who are supplying the loser. So it doesn't really matter who you support or supply. An industry, you know, the Krupp Industries and General Motors were working together in World War II. You know, I mean, come on, they're making a profit on both ends, you know.
You realize now that you've used the word parasite in both the first segment and the second segment, I'm going to have to find a way to work it into the third segment. I'm sorry.
Well, of course, it has
to be done. So,
Scalia is a parasite, isn't he?
Well, here's the question, though. I mean, it's easy to say war is hell, war is terrible, war is awful, and a deadly awful thing. That's easy because it's true. But some wars, I contend, and I think even both of you, when pushed against the wall, would agree, some wars are necessary, evil and horrible, but necessary, and other wars are completely ridiculous, horrible wastes of lives and money and everything. So, I mean, I'm not willing to be a pacifist nation. I'm not willing to forego all wars. I do think some wars, particularly wars that stop mass murder, are a good thing. I supported the war in Kosovo in Bill Clinton's time, World War II. You can think of examples. You can also think of really ridiculous examples like Vietnam and Iraq and so forth. And
Grenada.
Grenada. And then more ambiguous wars like Afghanistan that I think actually was correct as a matter of self-defense for a few months and then unfortunately lasted 12 years. So, you know, it's easy to condemn war, but when you get into the nitty-gritty of it all, there's all kinds of gradations.
Well, you got to change the conversation. And, you know, I'm happy to say that we, in fact, have changed the conversation because if you remember way back when we began the Raucous Caucus, we've discussed the issue of war before, and we've discussed the issue of what used to be called justified war. And I screamed and yelled that we should call it, yes, there are some necessary wars, which is a big difference than justified.
Right, yeah.
And Mark, you've used that term. We've changed the conversation.
I'm okay
already.
With necessary war. I'm okay with that. But my point is I'm not a pacifist, and that, you know, the clearest example of pacifism I can think of is the poor Tibetans who had a wonderful, beautiful country and believed in pacifism, and China just went and invaded it all, and no one can do anything about it because China is too powerful. But, you know, pacifism is not always the right solution. I will agree with you that we are way overwarred and there's a huge profit center and all the things that both of you said, I agree with you. But like I said, it's not so simple as to say you know, I mean, all war is hell. That's true, and yet some wars are unfortunately necessary.
Well, one of the other things too, we've got to think about the language, because I've caught myself so many times, and I always forget. And at one point, I said, "I'm not going to call it a war anymore in Iraq. It was an invasion."
Right.
It was not a war, and subsequently, it was an occupation. So one of the things that we do, and we all do because it's what our society has classified, you know, in the context of America, we are involved in military exercises and military actions so often that we've grown to just use the word war. But at many times, we are attacking someone, we are invading someone, or we are just bombing someone, or we are... you know, occupying a country. And I think one of the things is that when the term war is used, I think it kind of benefits the military-industrial complex, because when a lot of Americans think of war, you know, they go out and they put a flag out and the troops are heroes and la, la, la. But if you call it what it is, an occupation doesn't sound nearly as patriotic as a war, and I think that's one of the things that's happened. We've gone to call everything war when we've got a lot of other type of actions involved that we should be addressing them for what they are.
And we've changed the language, you know, we was historically from, you know, back during the Civil War, from, you know, the Department of War, the Department of Defense.
Well,
1948.
We're no longer defending squat. We're just attacking everywhere. The other thing to remember, which is so important about this, and this again goes back to de Tocqueville, is he talks about the habits of men and the culture. And there is no way you can separate our militarism from our obsession with guns on a personal and individual level. They
are
directly connected.
You know, Terry, let me push back, because Canada, I think, has a gun culture every bit as much as we do. They certainly got hunters. They probably have a greater percentage of Canadians. I don't know this, but I bet if I looked it up, I'd find that a greater percentage of Canadians own guns than Americans. About 20% of Americans own guns. Canadians, because of their backwoods culture and hunting, they have a lot of guns, but they don't fight in hardly any wars. A few that they join with us. So I don't know that those two necessarily go together.
I think you need
to check that, Mark, because I don't think you're right there. I think they've got some pretty darn stringent firearms.
They
laws.
Do. They have those laws, but people own, in terms of just gun ownership, a lot of Canadians own guns.
But they don't have the culture
that
we have, that I have to have a gun because my neighbor might attack me. And that's our culture.
Well, that's Canadians are too friendly to attack.
Yeah.
They're like, hey, you betcha. Can I get a cup of sugar? I mean, I don't know. Okay, that was terrible. But
well, they just have a broader based culture than we do.
They're
our culture
than
has
we are.
Become, like de Tocqueville warned, focused on militarism, designed to serve militarism, be it in the home, the community, or the nation. It is our focus, and somehow that we got to support Obama on this, at least in terms of this discussion, because it's the only way we're going to turn anything around.
And in fact, you know, that warlike obsession we have in our culture has bled down to our politics. I mean, you know, our politics have gone to two warring sides. You have, and I'm going to say overwhelmingly on one side, all of these insane ideas that the other side is going to attack them. I read some totally nutcase article where there was these people on this right-wing talk show saying that President Obama was going to put together an army of armed black people who were going to go out and massacre white people. So therefore, they had to all be armed and ready to stop the hordes of armed black people who were going to go through, you know, the 11% of the country that was going to, you know, go wipe out the rest of the other, you know, whatever, 75%.
See, it's
and you have to admit, you know, part of the gun problem here in this country is, frankly, we are in an individual arms race.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's driving it to a large degree.
And as ridiculous is the idea of President Obama arming black people to go across the country and do whatever, Garland, you have, though, given me my great segue into the third segment, so I appreciate that.
You're going to go across the country killing white people?
Close. Antonin Scalia wants to know if voting should be a sign of a racial entitlement. He didn't talk about an entitlement to go across the country and shoot people, but apparently Scalia is a little as afraid of blacks voting as some crazy people are of an armed black army. And we'll get to Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act when we come back right after this. Welcome back to the third and final segment of the Raucous Caucus. This is Mark Levine. I'm here with
Gary D. Kester.
And
Garland Nixon.
And we're moving on to the third segment, and that is Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. The United States Supreme Court heard oral argument this week on whether or not the Voting Rights Act of 1965, specifically Section 5, which requires certain states and localities to get pre-clearance from the Justice Department before they take actions that would deny minorities the right to vote or take away, dilute their voting power. This has been around since 1965. Many people are aware of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. That's the one that ended desegregation and allowed Rosa Parks to sit in the front and allowed African-Americans to go to hotels and theaters and restaurants and so forth. That one, I think, is more well-known, but the 1965 Voting Rights Act is certainly, if not equally, up there as the second most important civil rights legislation. It's the one that got rid of literacy tests and grandfather clauses and requiring people, African-Americans, to say how many jelly beans are in a jar in order to vote. The other thing it did is it actually stopped some of the gerrymandering. And most recently, Section 5 of the Civil Rights Act was used to stop states all across the country from requiring discriminatory voting IDs, basically because African Americans and poor people are less likely to have a photo voter ID. They tried to use these to disenfranchise a whole bunch of people. In some places, it was millions. And through the power of the Voting Rights Act, they were able to stop that. Now, Scalia seemed most offended by the fact that the Voting Rights Act only applies to some states and not others. Chief Justice Roberts, in fact, asked the government attorney representing the Obama administration if the South was more racist than the rest of the country. But what Chief Justice Roberts and Scalia must have known is that the Voting Rights Act, this Section 5, doesn't just apply to the South. Yes, it does apply to Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, South Carolina. It also applies to Arizona and Alaska. It also applies to the Bronx and certain communities in New Hampshire and Michigan.
And Massachusetts.
That's right. It applies to communities that have had a history of voting discrimination against minorities. And the best thing you might say for the communities is if you don't discriminate in 10 years, you don't have to worry about Section 5 of the Civil Rights Act. Notwithstanding that, and notwithstanding the fact that it was unanimously approved by Congress, the Senate voted 98-0 to reauthorize the Voting Rights Act. It sure looks like the five conservative justices of the Supreme Court are likely to strike it down come June.
Well, one of the things that I've also found reading up on that is part of this right-wing argument and part of the judge's argument against the stance that, hey, it was overwhelmingly, you know, almost unanimously in Congress passed. Basically, they kind of used Mitt Romney's 47% argument. They said something to the effect of, if you interpret what Robert said and what Scalia said, some of the things they said, what they said was, there's so many people that are dependent on the government. There's so many of these people that are dependent on these entitlements and handouts now that the Congress can't act against them out of fear for being voted out. So it was an argument for judicial activism because basically they're saying, well, Congress can't stop this. They're afraid to because of all of these people who are on, who are dependent on the government. So we have to act.
It's funny.
Congress can't act.
Justice Sotomayor responded to that argument by saying, is voting a racial entitlement? Apparently she asked the question 5 or 6 times and never got an answer. What say you, Terry?
Well, that is part of what we're talking about a little bit before, too, about language. I mean, I have not heard that term before. Scalia certainly raised it to another level. That is a dangerous term. I guarantee you the Republicans will pick up that term, and everybody who's against, affirmative action, et cetera, will be using that term like crazy. Thank you, Antoine Scalia. The guy is... Talk about a parasite. Holy cow.
But, you did it. You did it. You get the bonus word. I think the Marx Brothers, a little duck comes down from the ceiling. We did say parasite in all 3 segments.
Hey, we did. Okay, good. The thing that's left out, too, that's so essential, and I think it was the one of the officers of the NAACP that I was listening to, pointing out that the whole point of Section 5 is to prevent things from happening before an election.
That's true.
You know, and that is its main purpose. Whereas if they reject that, what it means, yes, there are other sections of the law of the 1965 Voters' Rights Act that can be used to stop a state from doing a particular thing, but it would be after the fact, and it would be after something has actually been done. And, of course, as she pointed out so dramatically, what that means is the individual or the county or the small organization who sees this discrimination, which is happening all over the place, they are going to have to get the funding and the money and the lawyers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, to make a case, which, of course, against the power that has changed the law, is going to be so much bigger, so much more empowered, so much more money, that they're never going to have a chance of getting a case up again to the Justice
Section
Department.
Section 2 still exists, and Section 2 allows you to remedy something after it occurs. In other words, if they disenfranchise a million black people, you could come in after the event and say, hey, that was wrong. But that's not going to change the election very much after the event. Maybe it would do something for the future.
But it changes the whole process that a discriminated group has to gain justice.
Right now, they just need the Justice Department. Right now, all you have to do is you get preclearance, and the Justice Department, if it's fair, and I think under Obama it's fair, not so sure under George W. Bush, but at least you have another entity, a powerful entity, the executive branch, looking into it. And I think the thing that strikes me most of all is the county suing, Shelby County, Alabama, had an incident just 5 years ago. Remember, if they don't have an incident in 10 years, they're off the list. Just 5 years ago, they had an incident where they purposely redrew district lines because they wanted to get rid of their one sitting black councilwoman. And it worked. They got rid of her. And, of course, that was why they are still under the act. But it just seems to me incredible that a town that just discriminated 5 years ago is saying, hey, you know, we're good. Leave us alone. Don't bother us anymore.
And actually, let's get the elephant in the room out here, and that is that it actually does make sense that Shelby County would be doing it, and that the places who are most likely to discriminate would be doing it. What we really know is this: everybody knows this, and we don't discuss this a lot, that the conservatives want to be able to discriminate against minorities, and this is not just now. Don't get me wrong; it's not just about race, as we saw in the past, in the last election. Minorities, and, you know, African-Americans, Latinos, and students, regardless of their race.
And poor people.
Right.
And disabled, and gay people. I mean, there's a whole group of minorities, and women, to
right.
a large
extent. So what the Republicans are trying to do is they are trying to stop the people from voting who would vote against them. Now, what's going on here, rather than, you know, it's funny, this is completely the opposite of what they're saying it is. Rather than saying there is no discrimination, we don't need this anymore, what they're really doing is this, saying, if we can get this out of the way, the laws that you will see every one of these Republican governors and Republican legislature, if this falls within days, they will be introducing the most draconian, you know, they'll go back to counting jelly beans. You know, if a black person or a student, you know, or, you know, you'll have to be blindfolded and count the jelly beans in a barrel. So we really know what they're doing here. They're trying to get this out of the way so they can intentionally discriminate without, but they'll probably wait until a couple weeks before the presidential election or a couple months so they can do it. And you can't sue until after the election. And, you know, we all really know what's going on here. This is another attempt at stealing elections. They're just going to hopefully change the administrative laws so they can do it.
Garland, I agree with you, but it goes one further than that. They've already done it. Don't tell me they're going to do it if this law goes away. They've already done it. In more than 30 states, there were at least proposals to restrict voting just in this last election. At least 8 or 10 of them became law, and it's only because of the Obama Justice Department and the current Voting Rights Act that we didn't have all of these horrible discriminatory laws happen. So it's not even like it might happen or the specter it might happen. It already did happen, and thank God we have this law, at least in existence today, to keep them from restricting people from voting.
And well, that was actually kind of my point, Mark. You know,
okay.
we saw what they've done,
right.
And they said, darn it, there's a stumbling block. We can't do it. If we can just get this stumbling block out of the way, then we can go.
Let me give Terry a chance. Go ahead, Terry.
Let me jump in here, guys, because, I mean, this is really so important and so valid, all the points we're making. And I had the privilege just last Wednesday on another radio station, which we won't mention at the moment, of interviewing Greg Palast. And if you want documentation of every voting manipulation and suppression that has happened in the United States, you've got to get his book, which was a New York Times best-selling book, Billions and Ballot Bandits. You've got to read that book because it verifies, documents, everything we're talking about. There is such a major effort in this country to reduce the voters back to that 6% of the elite that could vote back right after the Revolutionary War. That, I mean, it's astounding. We really have a war on the democratic process here, or what's left of it, even in terms of voting. It's astounding. And it's serious, and it's real. And if the Supreme Court gets rid of this Section 5, you're right. We're going to go backwards so fast. You guys are going to be astounded.
It's interesting.
And it's
going to happen. If you listen to the oral arguments, it struck me that far more than the actuality of Section 5, the real voting laws that have been passed or attempted to be passed, and the real incidents that Congress, frankly, devoted reams of material and papers and hearings when they reauthorized the Voting Rights Act, it wasn't about the reality at all. It struck me that the thing that concerned Scalia, Roberts, frankly, to some extent, Kennedy as well, Alito too, and Thomas is, of course, notorious on this. The thing that struck them is they really felt like it was bad to single out the racists, to say that Louisiana, Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, again, not just southern states, South Carolina, but also Alaska, Arizona, and parts of New York, Michigan, New Hampshire, and other places. But to single them out as racist, they seemed to really not like the singling out. They thought it was sort of unfair or unfortunate, even though 80% of the Section 2 cases, those are the cases where people bring a lawsuit after the fact. They don't get clearance from the Justice Department. 80% of those cases happen to occur in these few jurisdictions, which don't make up more than about a third of the country. So, but notwithstanding all of that, there's an easy solution. It's something I've pointed out in the past. If you think it's wrong to single out Alabama, or Louisiana, or Alaska, Arizona, I have an
Include
easy solution.
All the states.
Apply Section 5 to every one of the 50 states, and bingo, there's no more singling out.
Well, the thing about it is, Mark, is this. I think you were incorrect in what you were saying just now that their problem with it was. That wasn't it. If, in fact, there was an overwhelming argument put forth that destroyed that position, that absolutely destroyed their argument that it was singling out the states, they would come up with another one, and they would use that argument and support it just as strongly. The arguments they use here, each individual argument, are nothing but arguments of convenience, because the reality is they want to strike this down, they want to take us backwards, and they want more conservatives. These are the people who put a president in, who completely ignored the Constitution and every legal precedent in the history of this country and put a president in office. So I think they want conservative rule, and any argument of convenience that they have to grasp to get it is what they'll do.
There's no question of that. I mean, this really is a major, serious issue. And again, it's not being discussed openly and honestly, as usual. It is by us, but not by the general media. And again, it's really significant to understand that if it gets passed, or if the Supreme Court has the Section 5 removed, then the individual who witnesses discrimination is going to be almost powerless to do anything about it, just because they're not going to have the financial wherewithal to do it. Whereas before, they would have a real power by simply appealing to the Justice Department. Justice Department would have to look at it, and something could be done. They're trying to castrate, again, just like they castrated all the gun control bills that we have, they're trying to castrate the voting right bills.
I'll tell you something. As I was listening to the oral argument, I was very, very proud of President Obama's two appointees, Justice Kagan and Justice Sonia Sotomayor.
Amen.
Particularly Justice Sotomayor, although Justice Kagan was pretty fierce as well. You know, there was a time on the court when Scalia was the only bad boy. He would go in, he would interrupt, he would say some really nasty, outrageous things, and you know that Ginsburg didn't like it, or Breyer didn't like it, or even Souter or Stevens didn't like it, but they didn't really call him out on it. They were sort of too polite. I like the fact that Justice Kagan and Justice Sotomayor are scrappy enough, particularly Justice Sotomayor, Sotomayor to not let this happen. I mean, she literally interrupted Scalia and said, well, Justice Scalia isn't noticing this, that, and the other, called him out by name. And, you know, maybe it's a shame to courtly traditions, but when you have Scalia already there, you know, hitting below the belt, so to speak, it was really nice to see people fight back, and particularly someone like Sotomayor, who has this amazing personal history. If you haven't read her book out, I want to highly recommend it. It's, you know, she comes, she's a poor kid from the Bronx, you know, a Puerto Rican neighborhood, and she grew up with nothing, and she really, she's a diabetic, and she's an amazing fighter, really, her entire life, and it's so great to have that representative on the court. You know, the, most people on the court, they've gone all the nation's best law schools, and that's all. But it's important to have on the court someone who has seen and recognizes the hardships of ordinary people. And I'm just really proud of her. And I'm really, you know, I criticize Obama all the time, but with regard to his two Supreme Court nominees, they've both been terrific, really terrific.
And Mark, are you saying that it really does make a difference whether a Democrat or a Republican wins the White House and appoints Supreme Court judges?
That sounds like a softball, Garland.
I mean, so far, it makes all the difference.
I got to tell
world.
You something. That we've had a number of 5-4 votes. Just about everything you hate that the Supreme Court has done has been a 5-4 vote. Everything from Citizens United to Bush v. Gore to the crazy ruling that on the Second Amendment. You name it, it's been done. If it's bad, it's been done 5-4. Eventually, justices are human. Eventually, one of those five conservatives will leave the court. At that time, if we have a Democratic president, we have a chance to truly, truly change the law for decades in America. And if we don't, we don't. And, I know a group of people, activists. I mean, I support their ideals. They're progressives. They're working really hard to get a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United. And I look at them and I smile and I say, it's a good cause and I support you. But I it's almost kind of wistful because I know there's no way they're going to get an amendment 2/3 of the House, 2/3 of the Senate. There's no way they're going to get a constitutional convention and 3/4 of the state. It just ain't happening. I support the cause. But the clearest and easiest way to overturn Citizens United is very simple. Just elect Democrats until one of those five conservative justices can no longer serve on the court. That's the only sure way to get rid of a lot of this bad, bad law out of the Supreme Court.
And Mark, and they know it, and that's what this is all about. They know that electing Democrats is the only way to thwart this right-wing, radical, individualist way of thinking, and they know that if they leave it up to Americans and they leave it up to people to vote in a fair, on a level playing field, that we're going to win. And that's what this is all about, changing the playing field so it's not level.
And you guys, I can't remember if we talked about this last week, but you guys do know that it's only been 2 or 3 weeks ago that Mississippi finally ratified the 13th Amendment?
Yes, that abolished slavery.
Yeah.
Mississippi got around to it.
By their own laws, they were scheduled to ratify it in 1995, but when 1995 came along, they thought, well, it's not really important. We don't have to do it that now, do we? And supposedly, you know, primarily only because of the film Lincoln, where
That's
they
right.
sort of forced into, I guess we better finally ratify the damn thing.
Well,
you don't think they want to put that, get rid of that amendment? You better do.
It's 150 years late, but hey, better late than never, right?
Yeah.
You know, go Mississippi. My home state of Virginia, by the way, is also revamping its laws. Currently, it is against the law for unmarried people to live together in Virginia. Now, apparently that law hasn't been enforced since the 1990s.
Wait a minute, Mark. If that's true, then I have to come back and go to jail. I'm sorry.
Apparently that it is illegal for non-married people to live together in Virginia. But good. Our representative Adam Eben, who's actually my state senator, is getting rid of this ridiculous law. Good for Virginia. Good for Mississippi. A little late, but like I said, better late than never.
Amen.
And speaking of better late than never, we're running late here on the Raucous Caucus. I want to thank you, Garland Nixon. Thank you, Terry DeKester, for being raucous with me today. You can tune in every Sunday from noon to 1 to hear the Raucous Caucus right here on WEAC Radio, AM 1480. I also post it on my website at marklevinetalk.com. So if you missed any moment of today's show, just check that out. So Garland, Terry, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Mark.
This is the Raucous Caucus, and we're signing off.
Bye-bye.